Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, December 24th. My name is Chris Klein. Let's take a brief look at the weather. Today, windy, scattered flurries, wind northwest from 20 to 30 miles per hour, Cedar Rapids high of 12, low of 3. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, Cedar Rapids high of 25, low of 18. The moon phase is waxing gibbous, rise at 1:31 p.m. and set at 2:10 a.m. Sunset tonight at 4:40 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow, 7:33 a.m. Today's daylight is 9 hours and 7 minutes. And now on to today's headlines. On the front page, written by Michaela Ram for the Gazette. Frontline health workers challenged physically and mentally. Sarah Eberle always has loved the fast-paced nature of the intensive care unit. Though the medical staff at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital ICU often sees the sickest patients in the hospital, they generally are able to recover. It's always a celebration when someone graduates from the unit, said Eberle, an ICU nurse. But since the beginning of the pandemic, that standard patient outcome has been reversed. By the time a patient infected with the novel coronavirus needs the ICU, they usually are required to be placed on a ventilator. In many cases, it's very hard for a patient to recover in that scenario. Eberle said she's held the hands of patients as they died more often than I care to admit. When you start to see the same patient type coming in every day and just not getting the outcome you're wanting, it takes a toll on you, Eberle said. We're not seeing as many people get out of the hospital as we did in spring. It's tough. It's tough to hold a patient's hand in the last moment of life. In the 9 months since COVID-19 first appeared in the state, the toll it has taken on the healthcare workers on the front lines of the pandemic has left a lasting impact. The recent arrival of two vaccines proven to be effective against the virus have provided much-needed hope for many. But for many, it has shifted their perspective on their field of choice. For some, it has changed their approach to their profession, and for others, it has given them confidence in their ability to provide patient care. It challenges you physically, mentally, and emotionally over such a long time, said Sarah Butler, critical care nurse practitioner at Mercy Medical Center's intensive care unit. It's remarkable, everything we've been through over the past 9 months. Survey results nationwide have found startling numbers of healthcare providers experiencing extreme stress, anxiety, and exhaustion as a result of the pandemic. One survey conducted by the not-for-profit Mental Health America found about 76% reported feeling exhausted and burned out, and about 75% were feeling overwhelmed. In the spring, when positive cases were first appearing at area hospitals, nursing supervisor Kelsey Huber volunteered to take time away from the orthopedics unit at St. Luke's to care for COVID-19 patients in a new unit opened by the hospital. Staff assigned to the new floor came from various parts of the hospital, all affected by the postponement of elective procedures early in the pandemic. Even with the fear of the unknown, Huber said, there was a sense of camaraderie among the staff. And again in November, when record-breaking numbers of new cases drove an alarming number of patients into the state's hospitals, the orthopedic floor was converted into a COVID-19 unit. Huber found herself managing COVID-19 patients again. The lingering unanswered questions about the virus and the risks it posed to frontline healthcare workers and their families caused much stress in the early days of the spring. Huber said she would cry on her way to work her first week on the COVID-19 floor, grappling with these unknowns. But by November, even as the hospital's staff and resources were stretched by the hundreds of patients, Huber said that anxiety had greatly decreased. We had more understanding of what we know and what we don't know, and that alleviated our anxiety, she said. We have a healthy respect for COVID-19, but also a healthy respect for what we can do. But it still has an incredibly challenging time for hospital workers. At its height in mid-November, more than 1,500 COVID-19 patients were admitted to hospitals across the state, prompting these facilities once again to suspend elective procedures and prep the next phase in their surge plans. Healthcare leaders pleaded with the public to take safety measures seriously or risk local hospitals becoming overwhelmed. Butler said hospital staff were working long hours, taking extra shifts to ensure all patients were taken care of. But despite that, the sheer number of patients made it difficult for Butler to feel as if she were doing her best. "I might be lying if I said I was doing all right," Butler said. "You worry about people and about how you can manage your work life and personal life. I don't think I was completely burned out. I was just concerned about how we can keep doing this for so many months. How can we sustain this?" Working in St. Luke's ICU, seeing what she calls the worst of the pandemic, Eberle said some days it's hard to tell that people care. "It's disheartening to see people not wearing masks, not maintaining social distances, and otherwise not following recommendations from public health officials." Eberle said the new COVID-19 vaccines are just a small indication that Iowa may be reaching the end of the pandemic, but adds healthcare workers still need encouragement for the long months ahead until the population reaches herd immunity. If you have a loved one or a friend who's working in healthcare on the front lines, send them a thank you, she said. You don't know how much that's appreciated. The next front page article is called "Judge Blocks UI Move to Cut Women's Swimming." This is written by Vanessa Miller for the Gazette. The University of Iowa's plans to end Hawkeye women's swimming and diving as part of a broader plan to cope with massive losses from the pandemic can't proceed for now, according to a federal judge who heard testimony questioning the university's commitment to equal opportunities for female athletes. Athletes, sometimes in tears, testified they were blindsided by the UI's announcement in August that it would eliminate the women's swimming and diving for which they were recruited, along with other sports. U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose said Tuesday she would grant a preliminary injunction that six UI female athletes sought against the school. Their lawsuit accuses the UI not only of causing irreparable harm to their academic and swimming careers, but of not complying with the Title IX of the Federal Education Amendments of 1972, protects people from discrimination based on their sex. "It feels like the team is slowly crumbling and falling apart," UI senior Sage Olenselm, captain of the women's swimming and diving team, testified about the exodus from the once nationally esteemed program as it nears its planned closure. During hearing on the athletes' request for an injunction that started last week and continued this week, Olenselm said of 35 female swimmers on the squad when UI Athletics announced it was cutting men's and women's swimming and diving, men's gymnastics, and men's tennis at the end of this year, a vast majority planned to leave. "About the only people who are staying is the seniors, obviously, and then a few people who decided they're not going to continue their swimming career," she said. "I believe over 20 have committed to go somewhere else. Four are going to leave right now after Christmas break, and then the rest are going to leave at the end of the year." Should the UI reverse its decision, Olenselm said, she believes most of the athletes would stay. "Nobody wants to leave," she said. "They're being forced. They were sobbing when they were leaving. They don't want to go." But coaches are leaving too, depriving those left of a chance at a meaningful last season the UI had promised. "This is my very last year, and I don't feel like I'm going to have a good season because we hardly have any coaches," Olenselm said. "Not to mention, I'm watching all my teammates leave. My best event is the 200 medley relay, and of all the people who are supposed to be on my relay, I'm the only one left." UI Athletics Director Gary Barta 4 months ago announced the closures in a somber room with socially distanced chairs, staying for only a short time after delivering the news, leaving coaches to comfort weeping players and field many questions. Sitting in that chair in that room with my coaches and my teammates and the other teams that were cut on that day was heartbreaking, Olin Sellin said. I literally thought I was going to be sick in the chair. Barta said massive pandemic-compelled losses in the tens of millions of dollars gave him no other choice. Citing continuing revenue losses from a truncated fall football season without fans and ongoing unknowns about other money-making sports. In an affidavit, UI Assistant Athletic Director and Chief Financial Officer Greg Davies told the court the self-supporting UI Athletics is likely to lose between $55 million and $65 million this budget year from the pandemic. Agreements between the Big Ten Conference and television networks are being negotiated due to the decrease in televised events caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the affidavit. Revenue distributions for televised events are still undetermined, but is anticipated to be significantly less than last year. When faced with Board of Regents questions about whether the UI could find another way to resolve its budget woes, retiring UI President Bruce Harreld in September said no. I'm sorry, he told the Regents, these sports are closed. But the Title IX lawsuit argues the UI was non-compliant with federal mandates for female athletic opportunities even before the cuts. The announced elimination of this women's team, made at a time during which the university is already out of compliance with Title IX, constitutes further unlawful discrimination on the basis of sex, according to the athlete's motion for court relief. At the time the suit was filed, the UI issued a statement defending itself, while also acknowledging the pain and frustration of student athletes. For starters, the university urged, the programs in question are still ongoing at this time, so they cannot be reinstated. It also noted the U.S. Office of Civil Rights recently had completed a review of Title IX compliance in its athletic department and found no findings of any violation in the 13 categories of Title IX. UI attorneys have yet to answer the original lawsuit, although they have filed a motion to dismiss the case on which the judge has yet to rule, beyond saying she will issue an injunction. The athletes sought the injunction while the lawsuit winds its way through court in hopes of keeping the program from falling apart. Separate from the legal fight to reverse the university cuts, a group of alumni and parents are fighting to establish a new financial model to keep all the sports, possibly moving UI Olympic sports out from under the athletics department and into a different campus department like the Division of Student Life. These discussions and efforts are ongoing. Now we turn to the Iowa Today section. The first headline, Court upholds ruling in favor of police in 2015 shooting. This is written by Trish Mahaffey for the Gazette. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit has upheld a ruling in favor of police in the 2015 fatal shooting of a Cedar Rapids man who was shot 24 times by officers during a traffic stop for suspected drug activity. The court affirmed U.S. District Chief Judge Leonard Strand's ruling that the four officers involved didn't violate constitutional rights or use excessive force against Jonathan Grossman, who refused to get out of the vehicle, October 20, 2015, after officers learned a shotgun was in the vehicle. Strand made the summary judgment ruling last year in the lawsuit filed by Grossman's mother, Twyla McElry, and his wife, Michaela Grossman, against the city of Cedar Rapids and the police department. The lawsuit argued officers fired 25 times at Jonathan Grossman, 21, of Cedar Rapids, as he was fleeing from an unlawful arrest following a traffic stop in the 3200 block of Ravenwood Terrace Northwest. The suit claimed the officer lacked probable cause to stop the vehicle and used excessive force as Grossman was fleeing. The appeals court ruled the police had reasonable suspicion to believe Gossman, G-O-S-S-M-A-N, Gossman, and the others were involved in criminal activity. Officers knew the individuals traveling together in a truck had separately bought pseudoephedrine and knew they had been involved in the making and using of methamphetamine, according to the ruling. Officers Brandon Boisenberg and Bryson Geringer had set up surveillance in the parking lot of Walgreens, 3325 16th Avenue Southwest, and watched Gossman and two others in a Ford F-150 pickup go into the store at different times and buy pseudoephedrine. According to the ruling, when the truck left the parking lot, Boisenberg and Geringer followed and contacted another officer, Nathan Julfs, to help make a traffic stop. Julfs asked for a canine unit, Officer Lucas Jones and his dog Bane, to respond with them. During the stop, officers asked the driver and another passenger to get out and find the driver had a knife, and found the driver had a knife, meth pipe, and prescription bottle, which he gave to officers. Julfs then questioned Gossman, who was in the back seat, telling him to hold up his hands. The driver then told the officers a shotgun was in the back seat, and several of the officers drew their firearms and told Gossman to get out of the truck. Gossman got out and started moving, and Boisenberg, who still had his gun drawn, couldn't restrain him with one hand. Gossman started running. Geringer and Jones and his dog chased after him. Jones and Geringer both said they noticed Gossman kept holding the front of his waistband as he ran. The officers were yelling for him to stop, but after a short chase, the dog caught up and bit Gossman on his arm. As Gossman fell, Geringer and Gossman pulled a firearm from his waistband, the ruling states. Geringer yelled, "Gun!" and thought he heard a clap and saw a flash of light. Jones and Geringer both started firing at him. Gossman died at the scene, the ruling stated. The medical examiner's report showed Gossman was shot 24 times. An investigation found Gossman had meth in his system and his 9mm handgun was loaded but hadn't been fired. Next is an article with the heading of Census Estimates, 3.16 million Iowans. State's growth put at under 1% in 2020. This is written by Gage Miskimen for the Gazette. Iowa's population increased slightly in 2020, according to a U.S. Census Bureau estimate released Wednesday. As of July 1st, Iowa has 3,163,561 residents, according to the estimate. Of that number, 77.1%, or 2,438,002 people, were 18 or older, old enough to vote. Other age breakdowns were not available. Iowa's 2020 population estimate is about 4,000 more residents than in 2019, when the population estimate was 3,159,596. That's a growth rate of around 0.12%. The 2020 population increase is less than half the estimated 9,696 people who moved to the state between 2018 and 2019. In the past decade, Iowa's population has increased by an estimated 3.7%, an increase of more than 112,000 residents from 2010's 3,050,819. For the country as a whole, the Census Bureau estimated the population increased by more than 1 million in 2020 to 329,484,123 people. Of that number, 77.9% or 256,662,010 are of voting age, the Census Bureau estimated. The U.S. Census Bureau is aiming to have the new 2020 census compiled by April 1st so numbers can be sent to the states for the purposes of redistricting. The next article is a 4-year-old boy shot, seriously injured in Cedar Rapids. Shooting appears to be unintentional, police say. This is written by Trish Mahaffrey. Police say a 4-year-old boy was shot and seriously injured in southwest Cedar Rapids on Wednesday, police said. No details were released, but police said the shooting appears to be unintentional. Police were called to the home at 208 7th Street Southwest at 2:42 p.m., where they found the child, who was not identified in the Cedar Rapids police news release. The child was taken to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital and then transferred to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Police said the investigation is ongoing. This is followed by another article entitled Woman Shot, Seriously Injured in Southwest Cedar Rapids. This is by Kat Russell. An 18-year-old woman was shot and seriously injured Tuesday afternoon in southwest Cedar Rapids. Police were called to 2110 Westdale Drive at 3:25 p.m., where they found the woman, who was not identified, inside a second-floor apartment, according to the news release. Police said her injuries were life-threatening. The woman was taken to a Cedar Rapids hospital and then moved to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. No arrests have been made, and the investigation is ongoing, police said. The next article is Iowa City Woman Accused of Neglect. This is by Lee Hemiston of the Gazette. An Iowa City woman is accused of neglect, leading to an older woman's death. The Johnson County Sheriff's Office said it began investigating the death of a 72-year-old woman on February 14th at 21 Apollo Place in southeast Iowa City. Tara M. Edwards, 54, had been the woman's primary caregiver, the office said in a news release. Authorities said Edwards, who said she was previously licensed as a nurse, neglected the woman by failing to fill her prescriptions, take her to medical appointments, or provide her with necessary nutritional supplements. At the time of the woman's death, she was emaciated, malnourished, and had suffered significant weight loss, authorities said. The Johnson County Medical Examiner's Office determined her cause of death to be homicide. Edwards was arrested Wednesday morning and faces one count of intentional dependent adult abuse causing serious injury, a Class C felony punishable by up to 10 years in prison. The next article is COVID-19 restrictions put brakes on bowl game trips. Limited or no fan seating allowed at football games. This is by Vanessa Miller for the Gazette. Just like everything else in 2020, the upcoming college football bowl season will be an unconventional one for Iowa fans. Even as many experience the typical enthusiasm over bowl invites for the Hawkeyes and Cyclones. For starters, due to COVID-19 concerns and restrictions, far fewer fans will be traveling to the game destinations, with the University of Iowa bound for Nashville for the December 30th Music City Bowl, and Iowa State University headed to Glendale, Arizona for the January 2nd Fiesta Bowl. The PlayStation Fiesta Bowl is not permitting any general admission to the game due to the COVID-19 pandemic, meaning only families of student athletes and coaches can attend. The Trans-Perfect Music City Bowl is following a Nissan Stadium safe plan that restricts capacity for the game to about 20% of its 69,143 limit, or nearly 13,830 fans. That means the UI doesn't have a fan allotment and isn't offering any official alumni tour packages this year. UI Athletics instead is using all its 750 complimentary tickets for football player and staff family members and other guests, according to Senior Associate Athletics Director Matt Henderson. Those tickets are going to football players and staff only, not to other UI Athletics employees or campus administrators, he said. For postseason competition, student athletes are permitted up to 6 complimentary admissions, Henderson said. Fans wanting to snag tickets through MusicCityBowl.com will find a range of options and prices, from $25 in the upper deck to $150 lower down. Most higher-priced seats, close to the field or near the 50-yard line, no longer were available Tuesday afternoon, although ticket exchange and resale sites like StubHub.com list Music City Bowl prices from $40 in the upper level to $899 for club seats. In a typical year, teams receive larger allotments to distribute with fan packages, with a big chunk still sold through the bowl game's home site. Had this been a normal year and the UI been chosen for the Music City Bowl, Henderson said, Iowa would be responsible for approximately 8,000 tickets. ISU's Fiesta Bowl isn't allowing any general admission. Only families of Cyclone players and coaches will be permitted to attend, according to Shelley Anderson, Vice President of Business Development and Constituent Engagement for the ISU Alumni Association. We will not be doing any organized travel packages or any type of organized event this year due to COVID, Anderson told the Gazette, pointing to a statement distributed publicly and to its alumni community, making sure fans know the matchup against the Oregon Ducks will be televised on ESPN at 3 p.m. Central Time January 2nd. We are so happy for our Cyclones and so disappointed we aren't able to be there to show our support, Anderson said. Next year! The UI Center for Advancement, which runs independently of the UI and handles alumni engagement, also isn't offering travel packages this year, according to spokeswoman Dana Larson. Neither is Destinations Unlimited, a local travel firm that's helped coordinate UI bowl game getaways with chartered flights in years past. Athletic conferences are truncating even team travel times this year due to COVID-19 concerns, resulting in reduced bowl travel budgets, according to the UI's Henderson. All those changes, curtailing fan involvement and thus spending, will further hurt athletic bottom lines already marred by abbreviated no-fan or fewer-fan fall seasons. There will be an impact on bowl revenues for this year due to the reduction in ticket sales, sponsorships, canceled bowls, etc., Henderson said. On the Insight page, we have a guest column by Tim Walch, the Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. The Joy of Christmas, 1945, a holiday memory. Christmas 2020, no doubt this will be a holiday to remember, but not in a good way. Millions of Americans will be kept from going home because of the ravages of the pandemic. To protect those we love, we must stay away from each other. It was a very different Christmas 75 years ago. The war in Europe had ended in May, and the war in the Pacific was over by September. I'll be home for Christmas was the song and a sentiment that captured the season when the greatest generation returned to those they loved. Christmas in 1945 was special. Getting home by December 25th was the prize that burned in the hearts of millions of soldiers. Many wouldn't make it. Some had made the ultimate sacrifice, and others were injured and in military hospitals. And the most common reason for not getting home was the simple fact that all those soldiers, even those stateside, couldn't find a way to get there for the big day. It wasn't for lack of trying. As early as September, the military launched Operation Magic Carpet to bring as many troops home as soon as possible. And as the holidays grew closer, Operation Santa Claus added to the number of men and women on the move. Here in Iowa, all was in readiness. Peace has come and a lot of boys will be home for Christmas, wrote one observer. And even those who don't come home at least won't have their Christmas in a foxhole. It was the best Christmas present that anyone could imagine. There were plans for Christmas dances, parties, and other celebrations, and with so much gratitude came a return to church. Iowans of all faiths made plans to thank God for his blessings. Congregations overflowed with returning veterans and their families. Particularly popular was the midnight mass at St. Joseph's Parish in rural Johnson County. Although common in current times, midnight liturgies were the exception in 1945. The mass at St. Joseph's was so popular with out-of-towners that the pastor issued tickets so that local folks could find places in the pews. More somber was the memory of those not present on Christmas Day, the soldiers who had given their lives for this country. All Americans prayed that God would be with those Gold Star families and fill the vacancy in their hearts and homes. Most of the soldiers who returned home for Christmas in 1945 are no longer with us. In fact, it is estimated that less than 3% of those who served in World War II are still alive today. But thanks to blessed memory, those patriots have not been forgotten. They still have a place in our hearts at Christmas. And 75 years from now, Americans will look back on this year's Christmas with reflection and empathy. The care we show for one another this year will ensure that coming generations can celebrate many Christmas holidays in the future. This year, staying at a distance physically will bring us closer together spiritually. Merry Christmas, one and all. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, December 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. From Belle Plaine, Greg Allen Schmenke, Sr., 65, died Thursday, December 22nd. In Cedar Rapids, Kelly Victor Kastorf, 63, died Tuesday, December 22nd. Dyersville, Jerome L. Jerry Koch, K-O-C-H, Koch, 84, died Monday, December 21st. Maquoketa, Juanetta B. Sims, 94, died Wednesday, December 23rd. In Riverside, Wilbur Allen Al Lowe, 71, died Tuesday, December 22nd. Walk-on, Rose E. Lensing, 85, died Tuesday, December 22nd. Other deaths, Alvin Reddy, 71, of Eastman, Wisconsin, died Tuesday, December 22nd. Betty E. Wagner, 97, of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, formerly of Lansing, Iowa, died Wednesday, December 23rd. Marcine Allen Hines, Marty or Dunk, age 71, of Central City, was born in Volga City, Iowa, and he died on December 20th. Mary E. Erger, 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on Thursday, December 17th. Due to the current pandemic, Mary will be buried after a private funeral ceremony. Dennis James Promising, Cedar Rapids, 55, died on December 22nd. A celebration of Dennis's life will be held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, December 29th, with an open invitation from 3 to 6 p.m. and services at 6 p.m. George H. Krukenberg, 83, of Loudoun, Iowa, passed away at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, December 22nd. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 26th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudoun, with visitation held from 9 until service time at the church. Burial will be in Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. Charles Raymond Young, Sr., 57, of Cedar Rapids, died from cancer on Tuesday, December 22nd. Services will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Rosemary D. Lyons, 91, passed away peacefully Wednesday, December 16th at her home in Iowa City, surrounded by family. A memorial mass is planned for the spring of 2021 when family and friends can gather safely. Renette K. Turnus, 65, of Shelbsburg, Iowa, passed away on December 22nd following a short illness. At this time, there will not be a funeral, but the family will have a celebration of life at a later date. Donna D. Manson, 93, of rural Independence, Iowa, died on Tuesday, December 22nd at Lexington Estate in Independence. Graveside services will be held at Mount Hope Cemetery in Independence at 2:30 p.m. Monday, December 28th. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. Monday, December 28th at the White Funeral Home in Independence. Cynthia Ann Pesca, 83, of Marengo, passed away Monday, December 21st at Compass Memorial Hospital in Marengo. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, December 28th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday, December 27th at Closter Funeral Home, Marengo, with a rosary recited at 6 p.m. Karen L. Murphy, 78, formerly Karen Dockendorf, died on December 21st in Washington, Iowa. And finally, Gary DeBow, 71, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, December 14th, graveside gathering at 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 29th, at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Cedar Rapids. Now here is an article, 175,000 coming to Orchestra Iowa in state CARES grant. This is submitted by the Gazette. Orchestra Iowa will be receiving $175,000 and the Iowa Children's Museum in Coralville will be getting $114,000 in one-time state grants aimed at assisting arts and cultural organizations and artists hit hard by the pandemic. The $7 million in grants announced this week comes from the $1.25 billion Iowa received from the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. The awards, which averaged just over $25,000, went to 267 cultural organizations and 152 artists in the state. The Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs received 550 grant requests totaling $36 million by the December 11th deadline set for the awards. The Iowa Arts and Cultural Recovery Program was announced December 2nd. The grants may be used to offset operating expenses and costs associated with reopening in person and adapting programs to virtual formats. The grant recipients include 15 organizations in Johnson County and 19 in Linn County. Among those awarded were Iowa Children's Museum, $114,000, University of Iowa Hancher Auditorium, $64,500, Englert Theater, $62,000, Film Scene, $59,500, Coralville Center for the Performing Arts, $42,000, Gabe's Live Music Venue, $23,800, Summer of the Arts, $22,400, and Riverside Theater, $15,300. In Linn County, Orchestra Iowa, $175,000. Theater Cedar Rapids, $142,200. National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, $84,500. Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, $72,600. Bruce Moore, $34,000. Iowa Ceramics Center and Glass Studio, $27,300. Indian Creek Nature Center, $19,300. Eastern Iowa Arts Academy, $18,300. Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, $17,600. African American Museum of Iowa, $14,400. Legion Arts, $14,000. And McGrath Amphitheater, $11,000. In addition, the National Motorcycle Museum in Anamosa received $18,400. The eight largest grants, $175,000, went to Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque, Blank Park Zoo, Des Moines, Performing Arts, Des Moines, Botanical Garden, and the Science Center of Iowa, all in Des Moines, Des Moines Metro Opera, Indianola, and Putnam Museum and Science Center in Davenport. According to information provided by grant applicants, cultural organizations have lost a combined $46.4 million in income since the pandemic began, state officials said. In a typical year, Iowa's creative sector accounts for 2.3% of the state's economy, according to research by the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Iowa's arts, culture, history, and creative industries, including film and media, employ more than 42,000 Iowans working in more than 5,000 nonprofit and for-profit businesses statewide. A full list of grant recipients is available online at iowaculture.gov. And now we turn to sports. Pack the Defense, Iowa Men's Basketball. This is written by Mike Hyas for the Gazette. Time is a jet plane, it moves too fast. So wrote someone named Bob Dylan in the song You're a Big Girl Now. Dylan is the only person from Hibbing, Minnesota, more famous than former Minnesota Gophers, Boston Celtics star Ken McHale. The fourth-ranked Iowa men's basketball team jets to Minneapolis for a 7 p.m. game Friday against the Golden Gophers. Time flies for the Hawkeyes. They lost to number one Gonzaga in a hyped matchup last Saturday in South Dakota, but shoved their disappointment aside in a hurry to start their Big Ten season 3 days later. Iowa rebounded with 70-55 home win against Purdue on Tuesday night, but the second of 20 conference games comes as fast as the first one, and it's away from Carver Hawkeye Arena, where the 7-1 Hawkeyes are 7-0. You have to put aside the wins as quickly as the losses. Neither is necessarily easy to do for some teams, but Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey cites his players' experience as an advantage in that regard. If there were an emotional hangover from the Gonzaga loss, it lasted no longer than the time it takes to pop an aspirin. We don't let it linger, McCaffrey said after Tuesday's win. Let's say we won the Gonzaga game. The last 2 days, we would have been ranked number one. Everybody would have been saying how great we are. And we've got to battle Purdue. We know what playing Purdue is like. They kicked us twice last year. So, I think a team's ability to understand that is going to be the key to success for the rest of the season. Defense was Iowa's strength against Purdue. Defense, or rather, a lack of it, was the big takeaway from the Gonzaga game. Our approach has always been to play the game, analyze the game, be honest with each other, and make some adjustments, make some improvements, McCaffrey said. That's collectively and individually. We had some guys that had some serious defensive breakdowns that shouldn't have had, which they shouldn't have had, and we put it out to them. We don't belittle them, we don't scream and yell, but we show it to them so they can see it, and then we drill it, and then we put the game plan in. Iowa's Luca Garza referred back to the 14-9 season he experienced as a freshman 3 years ago. When you add up all the experience we have, we know how to bounce back from losses, Garza said. With all the adversity we had last year, I think we had freshmen who grew up really quick in CJ, Frederick, and Joe Toussaint. Going through last year for them has made them veterans, and they're only sophomores. Toussaint is a point guard who gives Iowa's offense a different look off the bench with his speeded-up attacking style. He had 4 assists in just 11 minutes Tuesday, including a pair of sweet setups to Keegan Murray for dunks. Frederick had 6 points in 34 minutes against Purdue, but his plus-minus was plus 25. That means the Hawkeyes outscored the Boilermakers by 25 points when Frederick was on the floor and were outscored by 10 in the 6 minutes he wasn't. No one else was better than plus 13. CJ is a complete player, so his defense was spectacular, McCaffrey said. So it starts with that, and then he makes shots. He moves without the ball. He makes plays off the dribble. He recognizes when teams are flying at him or when they're overplaying him. Essentially, he's always in the right place and always making the right decision. From the first time I started watching him play, he's never been a mistake guy. A lot of guys aren't. They make mistakes, they make bad decisions, put their heads down, and drive into traffic. And he just constantly makes the right decision, and he always puts winning first. Iowa will need more defense Friday. Minnesota junior guard Marcus Carr is averaging 25 points and 6.3 assists over 7 home games, all wins. The Hawkeyes' victory over Purdue is in the contrails the Jets paint across the sky. The next game is almost here. Again. The next piece is entitled Montezuma Just Rolls On, and this is submitted by Jeff Linder. Nearly a quarter century has passed since Janelle Burgess played basketball at Iowa State. She still carries one of Bill Fennelly's philosophies. "We want to shoot the ball before we throw it away," she said. Class 1A ninth-ranked Montezuma, 9-1, shoots it often and shoots it far. The Bravettes average 10.2 three-pointers per game in 29.2 attempts. More than half of their attempts have come from long distance. "Some things never change, huh?" Burgess said. "We've got kids at all five positions that can shoot." You can be forgiven if you thought the Bravettes would take a step backward after 3 consecutive state tournament trips. 3 starters graduated, including Shatia Wettering, who now is at the University of Iowa. "The players and the uniforms have changed a little, but we didn't want things to change," said Burgess, now in her 4th season and the owner of an 84-9 record at her alma mater. "We shoot well, we play well defensively, and our senior leadership has been dynamic." Senior Elise Bolton leads the team at 17.1 points per game. She shoots 45.5% from long range, but is more than just a long-range chucker. She has become a handy all-around point guard, contributing 5 assists and 3 steals per game. Bolton is one of 4 double-figure scorers. Sophomore Elise Bolton, 10.9 points per game, junior Shanae Wettering, 10.1, and senior Dylan Holland, 10.0 points, 8.5 rebounds per game are the others. "It's cool to watch Shanae come into her own and be her own player," Burgess said. "Dylan is a blue-collar player who does everything we ask. It's a very unique group. There's no glitz or glamour here." 6 area teams take unblemished records into the holiday break, including one significant surprise. Bolstered by a 50-46 win over preseason Upper Iowa Conference favorite Turkey Valley on December 8th, North Fayette Valley is 7-0. "The girls are having some fun, and this is by far the most depth I've had," said Jim Calkins in his 9th year as NFV head coach. Senior Abby Richter leads the team at 14.3 points per game, and the Tiger Hawks have been aided by the arrival of senior Reagan Griffith, 9.0 points per game, who moved into the district when her father was hired as superintendent. "The girls have meshed well," Calkin said. "They're starting to understand what it takes to become a competitive team, and now they're a team that can win against just about anybody. The Tiger Hawks' perfection will be put to the test twice shortly after the break, at MFL Marmac, January 8th, and at home against Waukon, January 11th. Also unbeaten are Tri-Rivers Conference West Division rivals Springville, 9-0, Maquoketa Valley, 7-0, and North Lynn, 6-0, along with Cedar Rapids, Washington, 5-0, and Iowa City West, 2-0. And finally, Key Components Back for Bulldogs. This is written by K.J. Pilcher for the Gazette. Monona, MFL Mark Mack has assembled key components to a strong wrestling team. The Bulldogs have veterans with state experience. They received a boost from some young talent. Don't forget those who improved from last season, solidifying the lineup and providing flexibility. The gears have meshed well. MFL Marmac owns a 12-0 record, climbing to 7th in the first installment of the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Association Class 1A dual rankings. The Bulldogs closed the first half of the season with the team title at the Iowa City Regina Invitational on Saturday. "We've come out of the gate strong," MFL Marmac coach Chuck Bachman said. "It's just kind of a mixed bag of pieces to the puzzle." The Bulldogs rolled in their victory at Regina. All 13 wrestlers in the field placed 4th or better, including 6 in the finals. Bryce Radloff, 132, Carter Decker, 138, Gabe McGow, 160, and heavyweight Jacob Trudeau. They tallied 246.5 points, winning by 122.5 and coming within a half point of matching the combined total of runner-up Pekin and third place Sigourney Kyoto. This came on the heels of a 42-39 dual victory over number 11 Denver last Thursday. The Bulldogs have at least 12 starters with double-digit victories and 13 with winning records after Logan Brown dropped to 20-20 and finished 4th Saturday. "I'd say we have pretty good numbers for a small class in a small area," Bachman said of his 23 wrestler roster. "If you have decent numbers, that means we have backups here or there we can use. It really helps out, because we can play around with our lineup." Unfortunately, they did it without Bachman, who has been separated from the team while in self-quarantine. He praised his coaching staff for taking the reins over the last week. "I've watched them from afar a little bit," Bachman said. "It's kind of unfortunate." MFL Marmac swept through the Cascade duels earlier this month and then finished 2nd to 2A number 8 Independence at Nashua Plainfields Tournament. Decker and Holden Mathis, 120, won titles, and 3 more Bulldogs reached the finals. Decker, McGow, and Trudeau are returning state qualifiers. McGow's placed 5th at 145 and is the highest-ranked Bulldog. The junior is 4th at 160. Decker, a sophomore, sits 5th at 138, while Trudeau is 6th as a senior heavyweight. The trio is a combined 55-3, with Decker leading the way at 19-1. The first installment of the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Dual Rankings were released last week. Two-time defending state duels champion West Delaware is 1st in Class 2A. Defending 1A champion Lisbon is 2nd behind rival Don Bosco. Despite not wrestling a duel yet, Iowa City West is 6th in 3A. Independence is 6th and Solon is 7th, while Williamsburg and Union Community round out the 2A rankings at 15th and 16th. In 3A, Linmar, 1-0, is 9th. The Lions defeated Pleasant Valley in their delayed season opener Saturday. Cedar Rapids Kennedy is 14th and Western Dubuque is 15th. The Bobcats beat Kennedy 57-18. In a dual Thursday, Cedar Rapids Prairie and Iowa City High haven't competed yet, but are 21st and 23rd overall. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, December 24th. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.